You're listening to Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast, a clear voice in chaotic times.
This morning, today's chapel speaker, Mr. Kirby Anderson, is perfectly suited for our Friday Forum Chapel. A widely experienced lecturer, Mr. Anderson has spoken on numerous topics, including Christian apologetics, current issues, medical ethics, philosophy, science, political science, history, and on the family. Mr. Anderson has been a visiting professor here at DTS, as well as at the Philadelphia Biblical University and Temple Baptist Seminary, and has written widely as well. Mr. Anderson is the National Director, Executive Director, for Probe Ministries, whose mission is to present the gospel to communities nationally and internationally by providing lifelong opportunities to integrate faith and learning through balanced, biblically-based scholarship, training people to love God by renewing their minds, and equipping the church to engage the world for Christ. And as I was reading through this, any of you that have ever watched the movie The Matrix, I couldn't help but think, Mr. Anderson. You remember that, Mr. Anderson. Hello, Mr. Anderson. But this is the real Mr. Anderson of Probe Ministries. Let's welcome him to our chapel.
Thank you. It's the first time I've been introduced that way, but I thank you very much for the introduction. This is a Friday forum. I know that some of you may be new to campus and you've never seen one of these before, but what I thought we would do is give you a chance to ask some questions, and so that's why we've put those microphones up there, so you'll be thinking of some questions you want to ask. It's a chance to put me on the spot on various topics, but I always like to do it sort of White House press corps style. I'll have some opening comments, and then you can ask any kind of question you would like. But I thought in the interest of time, what I might do is maybe focus on three trends that I think every seminary student needs to pay attention to. And the first would be a religious trend. And I think it takes off of what is going to be taking place on Monday. I think if I were to ask any of you, where were you September 11th, 2001, you would know where you were. You might not know what you had for lunch yesterday, but you remember where you were 5 years ago. And because of that, I think there has been a very healthy understanding on the part of the Christian community about Islam. Now, maybe you knew some things about Islam before, but I would imagine you, like many of the rest of us, even at Probe Ministries, began to read a little bit more. There have been some excellent books produced on the subject of Islam. And it really is one of the great challenges, one of the great trends that I think we're going to have to pay attention to here in the seminary and as you go out into your ministry. A number of years ago, Samuel Huntington, professor at Harvard University, I've had a chance to share a platform with him, wrote a book called The Clash of Civilizations. And he was predicting that in the 21st century, he believed that we would have a clash between three major civilizations. The first would be what he called Western Universalism, everything that we've come to know about the West, constitutional government, human rights, equal protection under the law, the various traditions, both theological and political, that we enjoy today in the West. The second is what he called Chinese assertion. That is, you don't want to ignore a billion Chinese. Your president right now and other faculty members are over there in China, and certainly that is a very significant issue to address. But the third, and the one I really want to focus on, is what he called Muslim militancy. And by that, he didn't mean that every Muslim country was militant. He didn't mean that every Muslim was militant. But he did believe that there would be a clash of civilizations between this radical Islam that we find in many countries, this kind of fundamentalist, literalist interpretation of the Quran, and the West. And he predicted that back in the early 1990s, and I think he has been almost as accurate as an Old Testament prophet, because that's exactly what we've seen. Politically, this is the great conflict that we see in the world today. When we talk about open countries, we now see that many countries are open to missions. And so whether you look at it in a political sense or even if you look at it in terms of mission sense, if you look at the so-called 1040 window, look at the number of countries in that 1040 window that are Muslim countries, and you can begin to see that this is one of the great challenges we face here in the 21st century. today, the countries that used to be closed to the gospel, Ukraine and Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia, are very open. Matter of fact, I've jokingly said that when I go over there into Budapest, Hungary, I have more freedom to preach Christ there than I do in Dallas, Texas sometimes, which I think says a lot not only about their country, but ours as well. But the really closed countries are those Muslim countries. What does that mean in terms of your ministry? Well, it seems to me that, first of all, one of the great challenges for Christians is to understand Islam, because they're not just over there. There's 7 million Muslims in this country as well, and so we'll be interacting with them. That also, I think, suggests that in terms of our teaching and preaching, we need to educate people about the Trinity, because I think the fundamental doctrine, one of the fundamental doctrines under the attack in the 21st century, is going to be the doctrine of the Trinity, because Muslims believe that we actually believe in three gods, and they believe that anybody who does not worship Allah is guilty of shirk. So there are some major challenges coming to the Christian faith from this world religion, the second largest world religion, Islam. And if we add to that all the other challenges that are coming from various writers, the gospel according to Bart, for example, Bart Ehrman and the misquoting of Jesus, the Da Vinci Code, we find out, was not just one phenomenon, but the first wave of a series of others that are waves of Gnosticism and skepticism. I think number one, the first trend is we're going to have to, in a religious sense, really understand how to answer these questions and educate the people that we're having ministry with how to answer those questions as well. Part of what we're talking about in our apologetics course. The second trend, we have a religious trend. The second trend, I would suggest, is a scientific trend. In the 21st century, we're answering and having to answer questions that people that sat in those chairs just a few decades ago never had to think about. Of course, we've had abortion, we've had euthanasia, but now these issues have morphed. Not only are we talking about abortion now, but we're talking about stem cells and stem cell research, and we have to know the difference between adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells, and begin to answer all sorts of questions related to bioethics and genetic engineering and cloning. And if you think that this is just an esoteric debate, any of you that come from the state of California recognize that it was a political debate, because there was a proposition on the ballot to spend $3 billion of taxpayer dollars actually to spend that on embryonic stem cell research. If you're from the state of Missouri right now, you know one of the biggest battles in the state of Missouri has to do with what we would call cloning, but they call it somatic cell nuclear transfer. So these are incredibly political ethical issues that we are, as Christians, going to have to think about. And even in your own ministry, you're going to have people that are going to come to you, and maybe they're dealing with infertility and they want to know about the morality of in vitro fertilization. They're going to want to know about when to pull the plug. I oftentimes get a phone call from a student that I've taught here at the seminary, and the phone call usually goes something like this. I know I was not paying attention when you had the class on bioethics. I have somebody coming into my pastorate here in just a few minutes, and they are having some very significant questions about when to pull the plug. I know I wasn't paying attention, but what do we believe on this again? That's kind of what I get, and I think we're going to have more and more of those kinds of questions surfacing. And they're not going to get easier in the 21st century. I would suggest to you that they're going to get more difficult. I did a week of radio programs recently on neuroethics. Neuroethics, you probably never even heard about that. But let me just give you one illustration of how this is going to, again, challenge our theology. They are talking about the possibility that someday they might be able to do a brain transplant. Can't do it now, but let's just hypothetically for a moment assume that we could. And let's assume that Chaplain Bill's body's kind of running down, and we want to keep Chaplain Bill around, and so we say, let's take his brain and put it in somebody else's body. Let's say they put it in my body. You know, I'm pretty healthy, right? You know, and let's assume I'm brain dead. Of course, some of the people that call my talk show already believe that's true, but nevertheless, let's assume I'm brain dead, and we take his brain out of his body and put it in my body. When we wake up, would it be Bill in my body, or would I be in my body with Bill's brain? Think about that for just a second in terms of what we say in terms of a body and soul. And you are going to, I think, have to address theological issues that are related to science that people have never had to think about before. And that's one of the great challenges. The third and final challenge, and you can begin making your way to the microphones there if you want to ask a question, is a political challenge. And that is, I am seeing a tremendous conflict between church and state. Well, no surprise there, but I see it in a different way than we've seen it before. We used to, in the past, have these really high-profile cases, school prayer, for example, or even in San Diego, whether or not a cross can, the Mount Soledad cross can stay up or whether it needs to be torn down. And those still exist from time to time, but the real conflicts that I think are going to affect your ministry are conflicts that take place at the local level. Zoning rules that say, if you want to expand your church, no, we only are going to give you a special use permit to do so. If you want to have a Christian school in your Christian church, we may not let you do that. Or even the most significant ones come down in a little over a year ago, in which the Supreme Court in the Kelo case actually ruled that you could use eminent domain to take a person's house, or now they're using it to take a church, because by taking the church you can improve economic development. Well, you don't have to be too smart to look around and recognize that some churches are located in very high dollar real estate. And you could come up to, say, Pastor Erwin Lutzer and say, you know, I think we'd make a lot more money in Chicago if we had a high rise there. Let's tear down Moody Church. Or you could go to, you know, Manhattan Calvary Baptist Church right next to the Avon building there and say, you know, this church is generating no tax revenue. Let's just get rid of Calvary Baptist Church and let's build a building. And so I would suggest to you that we are living in a time when some of those church-state conflicts, which before we sort of yawned about because they affected something that we didn't really care about that much, would affect us very significantly here in the 21st century. And that all at a time in which there seems to be a growing apathy in the Christian community. If you go back and look at the statistics, according to George Barna, he estimates there are about 24 million Christians who are not registered to vote. Self-identified Christians who are not registered to vote. Now, that's Christians in the broad sense. That would be evangelicals and other Protestants and even Catholics. But still, that's a pretty high percentage of people who are not even registered to vote. Then you look at those people who are registered to vote who don't vote, and you can see that there's a high level of political apathy at a time when we've had some of the closest elections in American history. President Bush was elected by 537 votes in the state of Florida. 537 votes in the state of Florida. At the end of 2000, the United States Senate was a 50-50 tie. And actually, if you moved about 4,900 votes in the House of Representatives, the Democrats would have controlled the House of Representatives rather than the Republicans. What about 2004? President Bush was elected by the electoral votes, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Ohio. And we've had close election after close election after close election. And at the same time, we have this mass of evangelicals and Christians who are either not registered to vote, or even if they're registered to vote, they're not voting. If they began to think about issues from a biblical point of view and enter the political arena, they would make a very significant difference. So with that, let's see if we can have a few of you come to the microphone, but I think that, again, we've got a number of trends that we need to pay attention to. Number one, a religious trend, the attacks that sometimes are coming against Christianity and the need for us to answer those. Number two, a scientific trend that is, in many cases, raising very important fundamental questions that we need to be able to answer from a biblical point of view, and a political trend in which there is growing tension in the area of church and state. First question.
You were talking about teaching people to think Christianly about politics, and I was wondering, as far as engaging the Christian culture, particularly the very conservative wings of it, there seems to be a trend's been going on for a long time where people essentially equate Christian with conservative or ultra-conservative, and don't take the time to think whether the conservative position is actually the ethical, moral position and that sort of thing. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions how to combat that or teach people to think Christianly in terms of individual issues, not just whether it's a conservative position or a liberal position.
Good point. One of the reasons why I think there's this growing apathy is during the 1980s, there was the rise of the so-called Christian right. And it hasn't gone away, but you've got to recognize there is no moral majority. Even the Christian voice is very insignificant now. But because of that, oftentimes there was maybe a dissatisfaction with that perspective. And so that's part of that sense of apathy. What I think is important for us is to come back and look at those issues biblically and not to necessarily tie it to any political position. And that is a very dangerous situation to find ourselves in, because we do oftentimes see individuals that say, well, the Christian view is. And I've seen both extremes. I was born in Berkeley, California, born in Berkeley, California. Okay? When I go back there, sometimes I will hear people in the San Francisco Bay Area say, I don't know how a person could be a Christian and vote as a Republican. And then I come back to Dallas and I'll hear people say, I don't know how a person could be a Christian and vote as a Democrat. So you can see that oftentimes the culture around us is more influential than thinking biblically about those issues. Now, the good news is there's a lot of really great writing out there by Christians that I think have thought much more deeply about that. I'll just mention one, Chuck Colson, his Breakpoint Commentary, really just challenging us to think about these issues. I would hope that Pro Ministries does that and other groups as well. But I think that is a real danger, that we do not want to identify the gospel with a particular political party. Paul talks about the fact in 1 Corinthians 9 that I become all things to all men that I might save some. And I take that even though I may have strong political positions on various issues, I don't want to identify it as the Christian position. There are certain issues where I want to say, yes, there is the Christian position on the authority of the Bible, of biblical authority, deity of Jesus Christ, justification by faith. But I think I'd be really far off if I would say that there is the Christian position on the International Monetary Fund or the Christian position on international tax policies or tariffs. There's a place where I think, honestly, Christians could disagree, and we have to allow for a spirit of charity in those kinds of discussions. You deserve a longer answer, but let's give someone else a chance to ask a question.
Sure. You mentioned our need to learn about Islam. There's going to be a class of civilizations going on, and a lot of these people here are going to be leaders in the church, and they're going to have full loads doing the things that they feel like God has called them to do. But what are some ways you think they can practically not just learn about Islam, but engage the Islamic community in America and see their part in reaching Muslims in the world?
Okay, very good. Where do you get that information? Again, this is not just a plug for Probe, but probe.org, you'll find, if you type in Islam, they were amazing, the number of articles that different staff have there. There are various books. Let me mention one. Dr. Norm Geisler and Abdul Salib wrote a book called Answering Islam, probably the best book from a theological point of view that you could understand Islam. If you wanted to understand it from a person who was a Muslim who became a Christian, any of the books by the Kaner brothers, Ergun Kaner, who used to be here at Criswell, now is at Liberty, and Emir Kaner, who's at Southeastern Baptist Seminary. They have a whole series of books on unveiling Islam and things like that. So the good news is there are really well-written books out there on that subject. If you wanted one that was a little simpler than Robert Spencer's book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades, you know, which is, you know, kind of fast read. So there are lots of those resources. Now, the question is, how do I engage the Muslim community? Well, most of you are probably going to end up somewhere where you will be very close to the Muslim community, but how do I break in? A couple of thoughts. Thought number one is that oftentimes Muslim students are very open to that, and so if you were here in Dallas, I'd say, well, go to University of Texas at Dallas or at SMU or someplace like that, and there is an instant opportunity to engage some of the Muslim students. Another would be to have a forum where you could have interchange and interaction, where you could have opportunity to have, maybe not in the pulpit or something, but in the church facility, someplace where you could learn more about my Muslim neighbors, and that would be the case. But there are 7 million Muslims in this country. There is no doubt that it is very easy to engage them in this country. And then I know many of you are going to be missionaries to other countries. You will be going to countries where that may be the dominant religion, and it won't be hard to reach out to the Muslim community in that regard. Over here.
You mentioned earlier about the fact how many self-identified Christians are actually not even registered to vote. And I couldn't agree with you more how important it is that we do get out there and we actually do exercise our voice to vote, especially with the midterm elections right around the corner. I wonder if maybe you could kind of illuminate the process for how to get that started, because I think a lot of people don't register to vote, mainly because they don't know how, and then secondly, because they don't even understand who's running or the reason why they're running, what their platforms are. Okay. So if you could give some information on that.
Of their stewardship. If I were in a pulpit, I would want to maybe early on have some message. This talks about Christian responsibility to society. And I would start with going to Romans 13, 1-7, and say that it's very clear here that government is ordained by God, so it is a legitimate institution, just as there is the church and the state and the family. This is a one of those institutions that's ordained by God. And I would point out then that we are commanded by the Apostle Paul there to obey those in government. Then I would go to maybe 1 Timothy 2, which tells us that we are to pray for those in authority. So we're to obey those in authority. We're to pray for those in authority. And at that point, then I would talk about my stewardship. And I might go to 1 Corinthians, where it talks about there being different gifts and different callings. And one of those gifts that we enjoy in this country, and many countries around the world enjoy, is the gift of the vote. And then I maybe would go to 2 Corinthians and talk about the fact that we are held accountable for how we've used those gifts and callings. And certainly, I believe that God is going to not only hold us for account of what he has given to us, but also our opportunity for political participation. Now, for those of you that are missionaries to go to other countries, you know that in many of those countries, they value the vote so much that they will stand in line for hours, sometimes even when bullets have been flying. And here, we can't get people to show up when oftentimes there's no more than two or three people in the line. So I would spend a little bit of time first teaching on that. Then there would be some practical things to do. One suggestion you might have is, if you're in a local church, is to consider putting together an action committee. One that, you know, maybe you have some people. Almost every church has some people that are really politically involved, and they're really interested in that. And sometimes they drive you crazy because, you know, they're just so involved, you know, that you got to figure out what to do with them. Well, then create a committee that is responsible to an elder and channel some of that enthusiasm in a positive way. And so they can collect voter registration cards and distribute those and explain to people how they could register to vote. In most churches, you are allowed to register people to vote in the church. There are some exceptions. For example, you cannot, at least in the state of Florida right now, you cannot register a person to vote on Sunday, which means you couldn't have voter registration, obviously, in a church on a Sunday. But most of the places would provide that and then give them some basics. And then, again, task that action committee to research some of those issues. And what we've done before, even in churches here locally, is sometimes we will have a lunch and we'll invite in the candidates so everybody, if they want to come, can meet the candidates. And I'm telling you, that has changed my life. You know as well as I do that when you're going down a ballot, by the time you get to some of the judges, the local judges, you're going, I don't know. Well, I've met almost every one of those, and so it allowed me to vote much more intelligently about those. And if you invite candidates to come to a lunch, maybe in the fellowship hall, and just give a word of why they're running and what they're doing, they will come. They're looking for opportunities, and so there are some ways that you could provide education. You're not endorsing the candidate. You're giving them great information about those candidates. Maybe there's voters' guides. You put all that out there. Make it available. You'd have to decide whether or not you think that's appropriate for your church. But those are some creative ideas that other churches have done to educate people. And once people know a little bit more about what's taking place in their community, then they tend to get involved. And so I think that's a real good way to maybe increase voter participation and to encourage people to take seriously the stewardship of the vote.
Yes. Yeah, I'd like to hear your comments on Christian perspective on the ethics of the war in Iraq. Which, as I understand, its primary goal is to plant democracy in the Middle East, and just the Christian ethics of that.
Difficult question, but let me try to give a short answer, and it really deserves a very long one, but let's take two issues. Number one, we do have in Christian tradition what is called the just war theory, six different criteria, four of which, first of all, determine whether or not you go to war, and those have to do whether or not there were any kind of last resort, whether there was a formal declaration and things of that nature. Then when the war is fought, some other questions about whether or not it had limited objectives, and it certainly protected non-combatants. Now, you can use that in two different ways. Most Christians that have looked at this have said that this could be justifiable in terms of the fact that we have removed Saddam Hussein, we have tried to bring about peace and safety and even democracy to the Iraqi people. Those who have argued against it have oftentimes pointed to some of the mistakes that have been made by the military. And I would be the first to admit that military does make mistakes. Every war has had them. Every situation has unfortunately had the loss of life of non-combatants. So that's how you argue it. But the bigger question, I think, behind your issue is, can we bring democracy to Iraq? And I think that even though that is a noble goal, there are enough people that are recognizing that it is difficult to grow a democracy in a Muslim country. Let's go back to that idea of the two conflicts here. the idea of the Western universalism versus Muslim militancy. Because when you try to grow a democracy, there are certain presupposed ideas that exist there. One is the equality of individuals. If indeed you take seriously Muslim teaching, so-called Sharia law, then women, I hate to say it, you are not treated equally in typical Muslim countries. Due process, equal protection under the laws, those kinds of issues are not part of the culture of Islam. There are some exceptions, but the exceptions prove the rule. Probably the greatest exception would be the country of Turkey, which is a democracy of sorts, and probably is the best example of a democracy in a Muslim country, but that's due in large part to the fact that the founder, Ataturk, really rejected a lot of the Muslim fundamentalism and really tried to build a democratic society. As a matter of fact, I think it's interesting, the first country that is a Muslim country that might join the European Union is Turkey. So I think one of the great challenges that we will have in Iraq and in the Middle East is that the foundation that is necessary to grow a democracy or a republic are foundations that simply aren't there. Now, can you, over time, bring about changes? Probably you can, but that's not going to take place in the next couple of years. The habits of the heart, the patterns that are part of the culture, I think make it very difficult to grow a democracy. Is it worth fighting terrorism? Yes. Is it worth removing terrorist states? Yes. But the secondary goal as to whether or not we can bring democracy to Iraq, I think, is a question that even people that are in favor of the war have some very good questions about.
May I follow up on that?
Sure.
I think I'm hearing you presupposing that that promoting democracy is a good thing. I'm wondering if that is a part of our Christian ethics is so closely tied to the idea of democracy. I don't see democracy in the Bible.
No, I don't either. And I would be the first to say that giving people freedom is a good thing. And I think you could make that case from the Bible. But in terms of democracy, as a matter of fact, our country was really founded as a republic, the idea of some foundation of laws and things of that nature. Democracies before have given you dictators. I mean, after all, as it was said just the other day in one of the press conferences, a democracy gave you Adolf Hitler. Democracies will give you Sharia law. So there isn't anything necessarily good about democracy. But given the choice between democracy and dictatorship, I know what most people would want to choose. But I don't know that even that is an end step. I think moving more towards one that actually recognizes people as created in the image of God, as our country at least does in the Declaration of Independence, would be much more an ultimate goal than a democratic value. So I would really agree with you on that point. Question over here.
You mentioned the trend of clash between church and state, and it made me think of Christianity in the schools. I'm trying to figure out if this is a non-qualified view or not, but is there also a reverse trend? Is there a growing tolerance of specifically non-radical Muslims in America?
Yes. So what you're saying is that sometimes we don't allow Christians in the schools, but we do allow Muslims. And the classic illustration of that came out of Byron, California, in which, as a matter of fact, we did some stories on that on USA Radio Network and on the show I'm going to be doing in about 2 hours called Point of View, in which we were pointing out that in those classes, the students actually were encouraged to take a Muslim name, to say the Shahada, which is the creed, there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet, to engage in the fast of Ramadan, to engage in all sorts of kinds of things, which I think were inappropriate. Now, the Supreme Court has ruled, and I think wisely so, that we can teach about religion. Nothing wrong with teaching about religion. I think it would be appropriate to teach about Christianity when you're talking about Western culture. It would be appropriate to talk about Islam and teach about Islam when you talk about the Middle East. But that's not the same, because you had students taking a Muslim name actually engaging in Muslim worship and all of the rest. What I like to do for my civil libertarian friends that don't see any problem with that is reverse it and say, okay, let's imagine that in the public schools all of a sudden we had individuals that were going to be baptized, they were going to say the Lord's Prayer, they were going to engage in evangelism. Would you feel that that was appropriate? And I've yet to have any civil libertarian say that that's appropriate. So sometimes we have a situation where we say if you're a Christian in the public schools, you don't have certain rights. But if you are of another religion, because of our idea of tolerance, we will allow you to do so. I think what we want as Christians is this. We don't want a naked public square, which is what we have right now, where we try to strip all religious values out of the public square. but we don't want the other extreme of a sacred public square where we enforce on individuals Christian values or any kinds of values. I think what we want is an open public square. And the ways we do that are we have passed in Congress what is known as the Equal Access Act. That says that if you're a high school student and you want to have a club on campus, maybe you want to have a Bible club, that you have the same rights before or after school to have a Bible club just as you could have a debate club or a ski club or a Spanish club or whatever. In other words, you have the same open and equal access. We do not enforce any values, but nor do we restrict them. And I think that that makes the most kind of sense. So again, I would think that it would be very appropriate to teach about religion in the public schools, but I think it would be inappropriate to indoctrinate people in a particular religion in the schools, whether it's a Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, or whatever. Does that make sense? Yes, sir.
I have a great deal of frustration with the political system that we have in this country. One party represents something which I agree with from a social perspective, and another more of a general ethical perspective, and yet neither represents me very well. So I have a hard time discerning who to vote for. Furthermore, to participate in that process, I feel like in a representative government, I need to represent those people that have elected me ahead of my own ideals, because I think that's really the goal of the representative government. Why should I, as a Christian, aim to accomplish bring about my own ethical values through the political process rather than using the church as the main vehicle to accomplish that, both on a national level and an international level?
Very good. And I'll have to make this the last question because we're going to run out of time, but I think there are a couple of principles. And one, I talked about the principle of concession. I never want to get to the point where somebody thinks that, you know, in order to be a Christian, I have to assent to all sorts of political agenda. And number two, I also want to come back and recognize that the primary vehicle for change in society is still the church. Would you not agree that almost every one of the problems we've talked about today ultimately finds its answer in the preaching of the gospel? As you preach the gospel, as individuals change in their hearts and become new creatures, then they begin to think biblically and they begin to act differently based upon the change that takes place. So I think the ultimate change agent in the world is still that we are salt and light and that we are to preach the gospel. Now that being said, though, I think we can still expect our government to have a certain level of responsibility. I can't say that the answer to murder is to try to convert every murder, because some people won't convert and we have to have prisons and things like that. So what do I do when I look at these parties and, you know, I like some here and I like some here, but I don't necessarily fit? And the problem is that we have a two-party system in America, and it's so institutionalized that what you have is that if an individual, for example, is concerned about various social issues but doesn't like some of the agenda of a Democratic candidate, the Democrat says, where are you going to go, the other side? And if other people are like certain kind of pro-family, pro-moral issues, but they don't like everything the Republicans say, what are you going to go, the other side? I mean, so the bottom line is we are almost held captive because we have a two-party system. I wish we had a multi-party system which would allow us to consider that, but we don't. And so the reality is simply this. How do I vote? I'm not going to tell you how to vote on November, but I'm going to suggest this. Principle number one is, no matter who you vote for, you're going to have some disagreement with him or her. You know, people say, well, I just cannot vote for the lesser of two evils. You know what? In every election, I voted for the lesser of two evils, because every person on that ballot that I've ever voted for, I disagreed with on something. You know, unless I ran for office, then I'd agree with myself, right? There's going to be something that I'm going to disagree with. Now, I might be at 99% and just disagree on one issue, and there are others might be 50%. So that's principle number one. Recognize that when you go and vote for a candidate, there's going to be areas where you're going to disagree with them. And so you, in a sense, are voting for the best candidate or the lesser of two evils, however you want to look at that. Principle number two is, and this comes into the book of Romans, if you feel it was sin for you to vote for that individual, just as individuals in Paul's day felt that it might be sin for them to eat meat sacrificed to idols, then if you feel it would be sinful for you not to vote for one of those individuals, don't vote for them. Now, a lot of people say, well, then I'm not going to vote at all. No, no. If you look down the ballot, I will guarantee you that you may want to skip over certain candidates because, in this case, I could not in good conscience vote for either of these individuals. It's Tweedledee and Tweedledum. There's no difference between the two, and I can't vote for either of them. But I would imagine as you work down the ballot, you could find people that you could vote for. So principle number one is recognize that there are going to be times when you might vote for individuals that you wouldn't completely agree with, but you do the best you can and use that stewardship that you have. And number two, if you ever felt that you could not vote for either candidate or a series of candidates, then don't vote in that particular race. But I still think there are ways to be involved. And I think a third obvious principle is if you keep ending up with candidates that you can't vote for and you don't like candidate A or B, there's a thing called a primary, and that is start working to get other individuals who are run could be elected in the primary that you could in good conscience vote for. In other words, back to what Chaplain Bill was saying, learn to be salt and light and learn to have some biblical discernment while doing so. Well, I need to end, but let me again mention we've got some material on our contemporary apologetics class, a brown bag on September 21st, and I will be up here. Dr. Ray Boland will be in the back. If you want to ask us some questions and hang around for a little while, I'll stay here until I have to run off to go do radio. And let me close this in prayer. Father, we thank you for an opportunity to just think about these issues. Iron sharpens iron just as each man sharpens another, and we pray that you would help us to sharpen one another, that all of us would think more deeply about these issues, that you would help us to begin to consider some of these religious challenges that are facing us and these trends, to look at some of these scientific trends and know how to give good answers to them, and even look at some of the political trends that we are seeing on our society and around the world. And I pray that you might find us faithful, that you might help us to be the salt and light of the world, and that we would go into the world and make a difference. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen.